Hello, welcome to Profiles. I'm Shauna Ritter, and today we have the opportunity to meet an individual who plays an important part in education and in our community at large. Daniel Barron, welcome to Profiles.
Thanks, Shauna. It's good to be here.
Daniel has spent more than 25 years working in public, private, and Native American education. He's taught pre-K through college. He's been a teacher, a coach, whole school change facilitator, and a curriculum developer. He began his teaching career as a student teacher at Bank Street School for Children in New York City, and then went on to become education specialist for the Mississippi Band of Choctaw Indians. A founder and teacher coordinator of the Harmony Education School in Bloomington, Indiana, in 1977, he has remained involved in the development of Harmony School and the Harmony Education Center. Daniel's currently co-director of the National School Reform Faculty and the director of national programs for Harmony School Education Center. Daniel was born in Brooklyn, New York, in 1951, and he's received degrees from Bowdoin College, Bank Street College, and Indiana University. He's been happily married to Donna for 32 years, and he has two children who are both teachers as well. Daniel, so glad you can make it today to Profiles.
I feel old listening to that biography, Shauna.
But you're looking good.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you, what first drew you into education?
Well, it really was by chance, in a sense. When I went to college, I studied philosophy and religion as my two majors. Up on an island in Maine, outside of Brunswick, Maine, and married very young. And when I graduated with a double major in philosophy and religion, there was really no job openings.
Really?
I didn't have a sense of what I was going to do next. I was so living in the present, studying a lot of Eastern religion, that I hadn't given a lot of thought to really where I was heading professionally. When I went off to college, my mom went back to college, and she went to Bank Street School of Education to become a guidance counselor and became a very highly recognized guidance counselor in an inner city school in New York. She knew my love and interest in children, and she suggested that I go speak with the folks at Bank Street upon graduating Bowdoin. And I did, and indeed it turned into an entrance into a profession that's been extremely meaningful to me and to my life.
So your mom was a major inspiration for you?
She was for my whole life to the end of hers.
Daniel, how do you define education?
Education is really the process in which we bring our children into the world and prepare them to take stewardship of not only their own lives but of their communities and ultimately really the health of the planet. I would say education, its role is to nurture curiosity in children, to help develop the will, the skill, the capacity and the knowledge to pursue their own individual interests and passions and talents, but at the same time to recognize their responsibility to engage fully in civic life.
Could you talk a little bit more about what you mean by engaging fully in civic life?
Yeah, that's the public purpose of schooling. I think it was Jefferson who said it's the responsibility of each generation to prepare the next generation to renew democracy for their time. And we live in a country that in many ways is a two-tiered country. We have a minority of folks who are well-educated, earn high salaries, and have extraordinary influence over the decision-making of the country. And as the world becomes more complex and our society becomes more diverse, it becomes even more essential that every student graduating high school is prepared to make informed decisions and contribute to the civic conversations about the future that our communities are taking. This is particularly important in an age where the environment is in great question for the future of generations and where there's such hatred in the world and threats to our own society that it's absolutely essential that every student recognize that they have both the right and the responsibility to contribute to the common good and to serve the public purpose of citizenship.
And how do you see your role personally in that?
Well, my commitment has been to education by and large in terms of helping teachers and schools recognize the importance of balancing individual talents and academics with this contribution to social purpose and common good. But I haven't limited it, my work, to the field of education. I've been engaged with, over the years, the Community Service Council for many years, the Youth Services Bureau Board, and serve on several national boards. The one that I'm working most intensely on right now is the First Amendment Schools Board, which is a collaboration between the Association for Supervision and Curriculum Development, ASCD, in Arlington, Virginia, and the Freedom Forum. And we're working hard to create projects in schools across the country that help schools become laboratories of freedom, where every teacher, student, and parent experiences First Amendment rights in the life of the school.
How do you have those conversations with teachers these days, given the current climate of No Child Left Behind, high-stakes testing, accountability?
Yeah, the issues are profound and extremely important. I find the conversation easy to engage in with teachers. Currently, our system of schooling, particularly in the inner cities and particularly with people of color and people who live in poverty, have been a failure to our children. Shauna, during the time that we talk in this hour, 25 kids will drop out of school across the country, 3,000 during the course of the day, and over 1 million this year. An overwhelming majority of those kids are kids of color and kids who live in poverty. So our schools know that we're not serving our children well, particularly those who most need to be able to use their minds well, to be able to articulate well and to solve the problems not only that they'll face but that their communities will face. So in the light of the inequity of outcomes that we see in schools and in my deep belief that teachers enter their field because they really want to help every child and each child, I find that moving the conversation from not just thinking about their practice as teachers but as to what kind of work are we asking our kids to do and how do we revise and adapt our practice to meet the needs of every learner in the classroom is one that teachers are ready to hear and are open to reflecting on their own practice and the practice of their schools. So engaging folks in conversation is not the hard part.
What is the hard part?
The hard part is actually changing practice. Many teachers go into schooling because they did well in school and they love school, and they tend to teach the way they were taught. Our modern learner in the 21st century is a very different student and brings a very different profile than the profiles that most of our teachers come from. Even our teachers of color tended to be the best and the brightest of their generations. There were so few occupations open to them that those who chose education as a profession came with tremendous skills and talents to the field. Today, the kids we face don't learn the way that our teachers learned when they were in school to a large degree. I would say research shows that probably about 75% of the kids have learning styles and dispositions that are different than the ways they're being taught. So the role of school reform is to really expand the repertoire of every teacher so that there are multiple entry points to engage kids deeply in learning. And it's also about knowing the kids in your classroom well, coming to know them as people, as individuals, so that we can personalize the curriculum to hook their interest and build on their skills, talents, and interests. So it's really about pedagogy. It's about that conversation, that dance between the teacher and the learner. It can't focus strictly on content, as much of No Child Left Behind suggests, but it also has to have a deep understanding of who it is we're serving. How can we make our curriculum rigorous for those kids, intellectually rigorous, culturally relevant and personally relevant, and pay attention to the extraordinary importance of the caring and respectful relationship that's a precondition for learning that must exist between the child and the teacher?
You're listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest this evening is Daniel Barron. Daniel, what in your own experience, you talked about the fact that your mom was an inspiration to you getting involved in education. What about your own experience in education, both as a student and as a teacher, has led you to some of these beliefs?
Oh, I smile as you ask that, Sean. I often introduce myself to a new faculty as I am the kid that you did not want to have in your classroom. I was a board student. My home life was intellectually very rich and challenging. My father was involved in politics, my mom in many social and civic affairs. And the conversation around the dinner table was often around current events and with great argument and debate. And argument was valued highly at the dinner table and in the living room. When I went to school, I felt as if what they were teaching was of little or no interest to me. So I was bored. I was a clown. I acted out. And I was not fully present as a student in school. Not even was I always present physically as a student.
Did you get sent to the office a lot?
I did get sent to the office when they could find me. I graduated in the fourth, fifth of my high school class. And it was only upon graduating high school that I came to recognize that that schooling could serve a different purpose and it could lead to a self-awakening in terms of getting in touch with what's important to you as an individual and then an opening up to the extraordinary world of ideas. And the study of philosophy and religion really did open me up to explore the history of human thought and to find myself in that history looking forward to what was possible for our future.
What do you think the roles of schools are in terms of balancing those basic needs, which you talked about having taken care of, and taking children and perhaps even their parents to a place where they can engage in self-awakening, as you said? That how do you balance those things out?
Right. When students are engaged in meaningful work that they care about and are expected to perform give performances of understanding to demonstrate what they've come to know and understand and are able to do, basic skills fall naturally because kids want to do good work when it's being made public. I think the real challenge is helping kids recognize that what they think and what they say and what they feel really matters. And the more able they are to articulate their ideas and their feelings, the more power and influence they can have over their classroom, over their community, and over their life. So much of my work and much of the work of engaging kids is around helping them to see what's right in the world, but also to see what's wrong in the world, to look at the inequities, to look at the complex issues and problems facing modern society, and then to begin to think about the possibilities, to be able to dream, to imagine a brighter future. You know, when you asked me what the definition of education is, I didn't talk about possibilities in future thinking, but I really believe that is an essential responsibility of schooling, is to help people to look critically at what is, to imagine what could possibly be better, and then to have the skill and the capacity, the will to work on the world, to transform the world, to more closely resemble what's possible. This was greatly influenced by the work of Paulo Freire, and he's had a profound influence on my life. I think, you know, we as human beings, this is where philosophy, religion, and education come together for me. I think we as human beings have an extraordinarily unique capacity that's inherent only in our species to be able to imagine something that does not yet exist, an idea with no substance, and then to bring that idea into being, into making it part of what exists. And in the case of being a citizen and a thoughtful, well-educated person, to think of those things that would improve the quality of life not only for self and for others, what can I do to make a difference and then act to make it so? I believe ultimately that's the purpose of education, and I think ultimately that's the destiny of humankind.
What in your – going back to your own educational experience, what taught you that? How did you come to the point of knowing that being in education and taking on broader roles in education was what you needed to do?
Well, I don't think it grew out of my experience in schools, other than the fact that I genuinely felt oppressed as a student in school, that when I spoke from my heart, I often wasn't heard and was often asked to be quiet. So I don't think that the passion for thinking about the future and contributing to improving the quality of life came from my schooling experience. I think it came much more out of the civil rights movement and the poor people's movement of the mid and late 60s. I marched on Washington with Martin Luther King. I worked in Philadelphia, Mississippi with the Mississippi Band of Choctaw Indians. And I came to understand that the inequities in our country not only affect those who are poor badly, but it affects all of us badly, that we as a society are only as great as the way we treat those who are least privileged in our society. Mm-hmm. And I came to recognize through the incredible work of Martin Luther King, Malcolm X and others, of the possibilities of nonviolent action, of organizing, and of working in community to improve those issues that really needed our attention.
You mentioned the fact that you worked in Philadelphia, Mississippi. How was that experience for you? I think if I remember, you're telling me this one time, you were fresh out of college.
Yeah, shortly out of college, from Brooklyn, with long hair, a Yankee.
What year was this?
This was 1974.
Okay.
Jewish, and moving to Philadelphia, Mississippi. And the probably the most challenging piece of all that wasn't what diversity I brought to that community. but what was most striking was that I came as a change agent. They actually gave me
was that
the
your title
of change agent, which I immediately changed. But I was expected to work with the Bureau of Indian Affairs teachers who were civil servants, many of whom have been in their teaching classrooms for 30 years or more, to help to integrate the Choctaw culture into the curriculum for preschool and the early primary grades. And I came to realize very quickly that the fifth grade textbook, state adopted, taught that the Choctaw Nation, the ancestors of these kids, were savages. Not only were they savages, they were taught in their text that the Choctaw Nation were gluttons, and they would eat all of their food in the fall and then starve through the winter. Upon my own study, I found that the Choctaw Nation were the agricultural kingpins of all the southeastern tribes. They had such surpluses that they rarely, if ever, went to war. And when they did have conflicts, they used a game, stickball, to resolve those conflicts. So the reality of that culture compared to what was being taught to those children was a horrific injustice to those kids and to their own pride and their own background. So we engaged on a course of study. The teachers and I and their Native American assistants began to study the true story of the Choctaw culture through inquiry, collaborative inquiry, and then infused the true history, that great history, into the curriculum. And that gave me tremendous and profound insight into the role of cultural relevancy in the curriculum and making sure that kids in the classroom see their own cultures presented positively and honestly in the curriculum that they're presented with.
How was it for you moving to Philadelphia, Mississippi?
Oh, it was really something. Moving from New York to Philadelphia, it had, I think, 4,000 people at the time, and it was the largest economic and population center of all the counties surrounding it. Donna and I had our first child. Jeremy was born in Philadelphia on the reservation, and we lived on a farm of 80 acres with horses and gardens. Our neighbors were kind and accepting. Many of them had never left the county. The Choctaw Nation, the kids were precious and loving. So the experience, although a cultural shock, Philadelphia is the city in Neshoba County, the county, where the three Freedom Riders were killed by the Sheriff's Department and buried and found months later. It is the place of Mississippi Burning. So to move into that culture and to be able to engage in honest dialogue with the local citizens and to be accepted by and large by my neighbors was really quite remarkable. I look back on those days as having a profound impact on my life, but also on what I've come to understand about the importance of culture in education.
Let's take a short break here and listen to one of the selections of music that you brought in, This Land Is Your Land by Woody Guthrie. You're listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is Daniel Barron.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway, saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me.
We were just listening to This Land Is Your Land by Woody Guthrie. Daniel, what made you choose that?
Oh, it probably wouldn't surprise you based on our first conversation here this morning. I am a Democrat, small d, and I have such a belief in the core values and founding principles of our country, which clearly stated that this land is everyone's land. That there, when I think of the Pledge of Allegiance, I know it's under some controversy now, mm-hmm. but it ends with the pledge to liberty and justice for all. And that liberty and justice for all has been a motivating and inspiring principle for my whole life. So many people in our country are disenfranchised. So many citizens do not have the opportunity to tap their potential and to give to their families that which they dream for their families. And Woody Guthrie understood that. The great folk movement and the great early democracy schools of Miles Horton had a profound influence on my thinking. And in terms of the democratization of schooling, I think it's just essential that we recognize the gifts and talents and interests of every child so that they can tap their potential to be fully human and to contribute fully to their communities. It breaks my heart that so many kids come to school so curious, so eager to please and eager to answer teachers' questions as kindergartners and first graders. And then we end up with losing over 1 million kids a year dropping out. And this is in an age where kids who – when I was born in 1951, mm-hmm. the term dropout hadn't been coined yet. The college graduate – I mean the high school graduate was the minority. The expectation was that kids would not finish high school because there was so much meaningful work both on the farm and in the factory, in the community, that folks could go do what the jobs that their parents had done, earn a good wage, have the security of the unions, and provide for their families. Well, as we all know, we live in a different age now. Over 80% of all new jobs in the fastest growing segments of our society demand rigorous post-high school education for the worker. And knowing that the kids that we're failing to serve in our schools today will not have access to those opportunities is, I think, very similar to the inequities that Woody was singing to when he sang, "This Land Is Your Land."
Mm-hmm. Daniel, you have so much passion about your work and about your values, caring about issues of equity, caring about education for all people. And yet I know that you must be coming up against a brick wall very often in your work in systemic change in education. What keeps you believing?
I don't really feel as if I come up against a brick wall because I'm working with people. And, the piece of relationship and on finding what matters to those I work with always provides me with an entry point to engage in the conversation. Typically, the obstacles are the system. The obstacles are the policies and practices that are put into place that are in dissonance with the notions of democratic schooling and preparing all kids to be contributing members of the great interdependent global society that we see that vision printed on so many walls of schools. Yet the policies and practices of the district and often of the school are in direct opposition of developing the kind of leadership necessary for every kid to be able to contribute to a global economy and participate in civic life. I'm spending more and more time working with district teams and working in the policy forum. I do a lot of work with the Education Commission of the States. And a lot of work with district teams because the districts have to transform their own policies and practices if we can expect schools to transform. Schools have to transform their practices and policies if we hope that teachers will go through transformation. And I just heard a quote the other day that I relate to transformation. It says, we have to move from I'll believe it when I see it to I'll see it when I believe it.
Mm.
And when we believe that every child who enters school not only deserves but must leave high school as a graduate, fully prepared to either enter college or a challenging career, we are failing that mission of serving every kid well. And we must look hard at those practices that can accept over 25% of our kids not graduating from high school, over 50% of our kids in inner city schools not graduating from high school. It's intolerable, not only for those kids, but for all of our future.
Daniel, what drew you from working in the classroom directly with kids to now working with systems and districts and policies? Those not really abstractions because you're still working with people, but
right.
More distant.
Right. Had you asked me as a younger man, would I be working with adults rather than children, I would have said without a doubt, no, that won't be my future. I loved working with kids and helping kids to recognize their capabilities and to find interest in the world and build on their interest in the world. Harmony School is a small school. We serve 185 kids from three-year-olds through high school. And so when I was teaching middle school, I had 30 students. And I recognized that being in a small community in an independent school and having the richness of the daily experience of interacting with parents and their kids, that we had something to offer to the larger conversation, the educational discourse in this country, and that because we were independent and small, we were often seen as an anomaly that's not really relevant to the larger issues of our educational issues facing our country. So at that point in about 1990, we opened the Harmony Education Center. And at that point, I moved from the classroom to Director of Outreach Services and almost immediately started serving the poorest communities in Indiana and the poorest schools. We worked in East Chicago, South Bend, Indianapolis, and New Albany, and were able to help schools recognize the promise of education and to develop the programs and policies that would allow their kids to more fully develop their full capacities.
And do you get the same, the same energy, the same juice out of working with adults now that you once did working with kids?
I do, and I don't think the work's very different at all. I think that part of my job is to pose challenging questions, to stimulate people's curiosity, and to guide them on a path of possibility in terms of rethinking their current practice and also getting back in touch with what they really believe, their original purposes, their core values and beliefs about teaching and learning, and then helping them to close the gap between their core beliefs and their daily practices and interactions with kids. I get extremely excited, greatly enthused when I can help a teacher recognize the dissonance between their belief and their practice, and then together help that teacher close that gap by bringing their integrity, matching it with their identity, who they are with what they do. Curiously enough, I think I play the same role with schools. I mentioned earlier how principles and practices and policies often don't reflect the vision and mission of schools. So helping schools recognize where those gaps exist and helping them to close the gap between stated purpose and daily practice, it helps to transform the school environment. And now I have the great opportunity to do the same thing with districts. Mm-hmm. So I guess helping people get in touch with what really matters and then acting on whatever realm of influence they have to have it more closely resemble what they believe is possible for all kids just gets me going in whatever setting I'm in, be it the classroom, the faculty room, or the district central office.
I read a quote this morning, and of course I cannot remember who it was by right now, but it talked about the fact that someone who's fully engaged in life doesn't differentiate between work and play. And you seem to be putting those two things together pretty consistently. Are they completely integrated in your life?
No, there's not. I don't have enough time to play. I think the connection is really strong between enjoying and finding joy in your work is really, really vital. I also think that one thing that I do in both work and play is I do both in community. In neither event do I tend to go in as an isolate working alone. And the notion of creating learning communities at school and helping teachers break down the isolation and the alienation of the closed classroom and become engaged in professional discourse and dialogue with their peers, their fellow professionals in their building, to reflect that, make their practice public to each other with the trust and support that they know they'll get from their colleagues, and then to get feedback from their colleagues in order to adapt their practice to better meet the needs of kids. That notion of community that I bring to virtually all my work in schooling is very present in my social and private and personal life. Bloomington's afforded us with an incredible community of friends that celebrate each other's great successes and support each other in times of loss and go out and have a good time together. So that sense of community that Bloomington has added so much to my life, I try in whatever small way I can to bring a sense of community to the workplace and the sense of commitment and responsibility and communal responsibility that we can take working together, making a difference for each child that we teach and each child that we share.
You're listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is Daniel Barron. Daniel, you talked about what keeps you passionate in your work. What keeps your convictions so strong?
I think it's a belief in the inherent worth of every human being. This extraordinary gift we have of life and the extraordinary gift of this earth, this little marble in space, what an opportunity we have to make the most of the precious little time we have on this planet. And what a waste it would be not to be fully conscious of not only the beauty and the wonder of life, but also the opportunity to contribute to others being able to recognize that beauty and wonder of life and the beauty of making a contribution to others. I think it's really taking advantage and being conscious of the extraordinary opportunity that we have as human beings to live a meaningful life. In a moment of clearness, when I pondering that age-old question, what's the meaning of life, I came upon this notion of it's to make life meaningful. It's to be conscious and intentional about what we do and to apply our energies in a way that not only benefits yourself but benefits others. And that's a conviction that's at my core and one that gives great, great joy to me as I work on those convictions.
You sound you're really talking about a spiritual outlook in many ways. How would you define your own sense of spirituality, if that's the correct word to use?
Yeah. I've often thought about a book that I might write someday called The Spirit of School Reform because I believe the work really is spiritual work. It's spiritual in that it's connected to something greater than ourselves. It's connected in a belief of what binds us together as a species. Martin Luther King said, in a real sense, all life is interrelated. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality tied to a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. Strangely enough, he said, I can never be what I ought to be until you are all that you ought to be. And you can never be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be. This is the way the world was made. I didn't make it that way. It is the interrelated structure of reality. So that notion of us being connected to one another in a way that makes me fully real and fully purposeful is directly connected in you having the same opportunities, and that recognition of our interdependence upon each other is one that defines spirit for me. There's also the notion of possibilities, of this creative spirit we have, of being able to bring into being that yet which doesn't exist for the benefit of self and others, that to me is the act of creation. It's an almost godly, divine act to be able to have an idea, bring it into being, and serve others is one that defines spirit, citizenship, and being an educated person for me.
I think this would be a really good time to play your other selection, which was Imagine by John Lennon. Anything you want to add to why you chose that?
No, I think that it's well-timed in terms of my last comment. I think John Lennon had a deep understanding of the interconnectedness of all people and recognized the walls that we build between us. The work of diversity, in oneness we don't lose difference. In our connection, what we come to recognize is the extraordinary beauty and value that differences bring. Multiple perspectives are essential to the educated mind. And I think John Lennon had a great understanding of the possibilities of recognizing what it is that binds us in common, but having a full appreciation of the beauty of our differences.
We were just listening to Imagine by John Lennon. You're listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and we're speaking with Daniel Barron. Daniel, can you talk to me a little bit about what you see as some of your other greatest inspirations? You quoted Martin Luther King. We've played some music by Woody Guthrie and by John Lennon. Talked about your mom and your own experiences. Who or what else has inspired you?
Martin Buber, who wrote the book I and Thou, had a profound impact on my thinking, and it really is connected to the nature of relationship. He taught me that when we encounter others, not to treat them as objects to be used for my own benefit, but to meet them fully in the fullness of their humanity, and what he would call we call authentic relationship, he would call authentic reciprocity, where the relationship is fully of me giving to you and receiving from you that which we have to offer. And in that giving and receiving, he found a spiritual essence in the reciprocity of relationship. And that has had a profound impact on my thinking around schooling and teaching and learning as well. For a teacher to have a full respect for the individual student that they have the responsibility to educate, for them to recognize that child in the fullness of her humanity and to show the kind of respect that the human deserves is, I think, a key to be able to reach the child in a way that can have a genuine impact on their life. So Martin Buber has had a profound impact on me. Obviously, Gandhi and his impact on Martin Luther King's thinking. Paulo Freire and Miles Horton, I've mentioned earlier, many authors. Sports have had a great they really have had a great influence in my life in terms of not only teamwork but of practice and of having a picture in your mind of what it is you hope to accomplish and then to work towards it. Coaching is a metaphor we use quite frequently. Teacher as coach, and the role I play in schools is often the role of coach. And the role of coach has a really clear vision about what it's going to take to be successful, and a clear vision of how every person on that team has a significant role to play, and that it's not up to the coach can't do it, the work. The coach can only inspire and to help others find their own potential in their own work. So I think the coaching metaphor that works so well in when you see a great coach in sports is very similar to the great teacher or the great school change agent. I'm trying to rock and roll, you know, and folk music has been an inspiration to me. Growing up, listening to Bob Dylan as a young adolescent, and recognizing the power of his message, the Seekers. Some of the early Peter, Paul, and Mary music, John Denver. I think music and art, performance art, it can be truly inspirational, particularly around helping us to recognize the potential that we have as human beings to create beauty. The notion of what is beautiful and how we can help children find beauty in their own lives and create things that are beautiful, both in through words, through art, through performance, is just an inspiration.
Is there something else that I should be asking you that I haven't asked you? Do you have a favorite question that you wish I'd asked you?
Boy, that's the hardest question you've asked yet, Chana. The hard question would be, why is it that we accept mediocrity? You know, how is it that our society that is so dependent on its young has allowed for so long the inequities of our schooling to prevail? It is a very challenging and difficult question, and one that I think it's the civil rights question of the 21st century. And I'm afraid if we don't respond to quickly, could lead to terrible, dire consequences for our country, not only politically but economically, and our position as a moral leader in the world.
Mm-hmm. And how do you answer that question?
Well, it's not an easy answer either. People in power tend to be the privileged class. And both the school systems and the economic systems serve them well. The ability to control resources at rates that are unsustainable serves this generation, this short-sighted generation, very well. So I think the reason that we're not challenging the deep inequities, that we allow ourselves to believe the myth that the civil rights movement is over and equity has been achieved, because people have, in some degrees, equal access to opportunity, we fail to recognize all of the practices and the belief systems that create a two-tiered educational society as well as our general society that tracks children of color and poverty into those classes and those courses that will never allow them entry into higher ed or into challenging careers. Their parents have no power. Their parents have no voice. And, you know, I think, again, it was Martin Luther King who said that violence is the language of the unheard. And the violent nature of our country is also one of the great kind of secrets that we don't talk very much about. We have more young black men in prison than we do in college. Mm-hmm. We had more people die on the streets of America through homicide than died in Vietnam during the era of the Vietnam War. The homicide rate in Indianapolis is horrific. The dropout rate, even worse. These are issues that we don't discuss because it doesn't serve the privileged well to discuss them. If we maintain the status quo, those who have always been privileged will continue to be privileged. And those who have been disenfranchised will continue to be disenfranchised. So the great challenge is, how do we give voice to those disenfranchised folks who our future depends on?
Do you think the public school system stands a chance?
I do. I really have to. I'm afraid of privatization of education. I'm afraid of turning education over to the corporate world to serve corporate ends. No, I think public education is our greatest promise It's our greatest hope, and it also has to go through a great transformation in order to achieve the promise of our founding principles and our founding beliefs of this country.
Daniel, for 25 years, you've worked in many different settings in education and also serving on public boards and various other things, all about bringing about voice and transformation and change. I know you have probably lots of favorite stories, but is there one that you would like to share with us?
Oh, I'll share my most recent favorite story.
Okay.
Okay. I'm involved in a school transformation process in Indianapolis, where there are five large comprehensive high schools in the Indianapolis public school system, and they've received funding from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to transform, convert all of their five comprehensive large high schools into small, autonomous, equitable, excellent schools based on personalization, based on choice, based on high expectations for every child, and based on relevance and rigor and relationship at the core of education. So we launched this project on Halloween, October 30th, first. And on October 30th, we had a gala dinner. The superintendent of public instruction for Indiana was there. The mayor was there. The head of the Urban League was there. All of the civic leaders were at this meeting. All of the principals, superintendents from township schools. I think about 200 leading citizens and teachers. Not to say teachers aren't citizens as well, and leaders. And we had this idea. What if we had high school kids from those five schools be the tabletop facilitators for the conversations at each of those tables? And, you know, some we ran into some obstacles, some non-believers, you know, some people who would have had to seen it before they could believe it. Well, we believed it before we saw it. So we had student forums in each of the five schools. We had a student congress for 3 days leading up to the launch. And then we had tabletop facilitators made up of mostly sophomore and junior, some freshman leaders, sitting at each of those tables, leading the conversation of the civic leaders at their tables. And that wasn't the joy for me. The joy for me was at the end of the evening, as I sat back and watched these 20 or 25 kids, mostly kids of color, mostly kids who have never been placed in a position of leadership before in their lives, come rushing to each other to share in the extraordinary efficacy that they were feeling. If you looked in these kids' eyes as they were reaching out to each other, they could have accomplished anything at that moment. We touched a piece of their capability that night that I hope every teacher and business leader was aware of at their tables. And at this point, even to this date, kids are at the front of the conversation. They were in their forums in Congress before the teachers began their conversation, and they're leading the way in many of the schools with the support of our VISTA project that we're very involved with, and with those teachers who know there's a better way to serve their kids.
I think that's a great story to bring our interview to a close. I really thank you for being with us today, Daniel.
It's been my pleasure. It's great sitting here with you, Shauna.
Okay. You've been listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter. Thanks for listening.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in April of 2004. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. The recording engineer and co-producer was Michael Paskash, Lou Ann Johnson, research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. In addition, this and other Profiles programs can be accessed through our website at wfiu.indiana.edu. For WFIU, thanks for listening.